Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, I'm Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. We are so excited for today's guest. We have the incredible Dr. Christian Duray with us. Dr. Ray is the Associate Professor of Food Studies at NYU. On top of that, he has written some absolutely amazing books, including one of my personal favorite, The Ethnic Restaurateur. In today's episode, we break down where food is kind of going in the West, specifically in terms of South Asian cuisine. We talk about Dr. Ray's journey, and this one is packed, and I mean packed, with incredible information. You're going to want to listen to this entire episode at least a couple of times. Get ready, and here's Dr. Ray.
Dr. Ray, welcome, and thank you so much for agreeing to chat with Keith and I today.
Thank you for having me.
It's so great to have you here. And I think, you know, Keith was saying just before we started recording that yours is one of the first names, if not the first, that we thought of when we wanted to start interviewing people for this podcast. And the reason for that is because I think there's a very small number of South Asian food academics who are using their voice in a way that talks to South Asian food academia, in a sense, and are actually exploring channels beyond academia. And I think that's something that I've really appreciated observing about your work is the way that you've taken social media, which frankly, you just don't see a lot of people in academia, you know, doing. But before we jump into that, I would love to just roll it back a little bit and ask you to start by telling us, you know, how you got to this point and how you came into studying food.
Long story, stop me. Go on. And so I came to the U.S. To go to grad school. And I'd done a lot of kind of progressive work in terms of trade union work, student politics. And I realized that I needed to kind of expand my horizon, read a little widely. And so I ended up applying the only place I knew some professors in, which was SUNY Binghamton. And there's a group of people around Emmanuel Wallerstein and Giovanni Arrighi, whose work was on global inequality. So coming from India, I was always interested in this question of why are some parts of the world underdeveloped and other parts of the world developed when the world looked quite different, say around 1800. So I would say standards of living in China, India, and Europe were about the same around 1800. And why this great divergence? And their argument was that, unlike most modernization theorists, they were saying underdevelopment is not a function of being left behind, but being underdeveloped by the developed world. So this kind of radical, mind-blowing idea for me. So I wanted to go and study with them. I went to a little working-class town in Binghamton, which is Binghamton, and in New York with these beautiful rivers, Susquehanna and Chenango, Native American names for these rivers. And I was blown away by, first, that I didn't know how to cook. I was a 20-some-year-old man out of Delhi at this point of time. My mother is Odia, my father is Bengali, and I've lived in Jamshedpur and Banaras and Cuttack and born in Siliguri. So I'd lived all across Eastern and Northern India and had ended up doing very interesting progressive politics, but had never, no one had told me, go home, why don't you go home and cook a meal for a change? That for me, coming to the US in some ways was the most important thing as an what I sometimes call an epistemic opening. It reopened my mind to make obvious, kind of to bring into view what was kind of hidden in plain view. I mean, the basic, I sometimes call myself and call my work as an inverted anthropologist. That's what an anthropologist does, is goes to another culture and asks all the obvious questions people kind of have no longer ask about. So as an immigrant at this point of time, just as a grad student, just crossing from Indian culture to an American cultural space lit up everything that was kind of obvious and taken for granted. First thing was about myself. Why didn't I cook? And I, of course, learned how to cook quickly. And I would say kind of domestic Indian home cooking can be quite forgiving, meaning I come from Eastern India, Odia, my food is mostly Odia Bengali, so rice and dal and a sabzi, a sauteed green vegetable with maybe panchphoron, right? With the Bengali five spice, which has what, fenugreek, fennel sometimes, and then mustard, kalonji, etc. And maybe a chicken curry or a kind of a fish and mustard sauce. I mean, those were a little more complicated, the proteins. But Indian food for a beginner, for me, who had eaten Indian, fantastic Indian food all his life, was in fact a bridge to, in some ways, posing this question, A, why haven't I cooked? Now that I need to know how to cook, how do I go about cooking it? And what sense does it make? And over time, as I cooked and ate, and of course, the beautiful thing about cooking is that you're always someone else you're also feeding along with yourself. Okay, in this case, we lived in a kind of a small house we could afford because it was a working class town. Each one of us paid, I think, $150 or $200 because grad school fellowship keeps you happily in poverty. And so all of us were in this house, and there was a Lebanese guy, a Lebanese American, Khaldun Saman, a Jewish American guy, Steve Sherman, and a couple of Indian guys, Ravi Sundaram, etc., who came and went at different points of time. And we cooked. We cooked every day. We cooked badly, most of us. But we learned to cook. And of course, cooking, the thing about it is, it takes practice, right? And it takes a bit of work and a bit of forgiveness from other people that it's not always going to come out right. And all of us were quite forgiving as long as we clean the kitchen after the cooking, because that was the big thing, right? Which is some people cook and make such a mess that it was impossible. We stopped them from cooking. So anyway, so this was the context. And then cooking became a way to, initially it was cooking to feed myself, feed my friends. I would cook almost every other night because I became a kind of a slightly better cook than the rest of them. And folks would come with kind of beer and wine. And we would argue about the, and discuss all the readings we had to do for next day, you know? So we would eat and drink and talk about Marx and Weber and Durkheim and all the sociological theories. This was in sociology, by the way. And Immanuel Wallerstein's work, Giovanni Arrighi's work, Chalar Kader's work, all these are great scholars of, in some ways, global inequality. And next day we would go in the morning in the bus and go to the campus and go to the library. And I was in hog heaven in the library. I had never seen a library which had every newspaper in the world I wanted, which had every, which could provide me with every book I needed and wanted. So I would just sit there in the library for hours, just flipping through books, nothing to do with my schoolwork, just flipping through books, then go to class in the afternoon, and then come back home and cook and eat and argue next day. I did that for 5 years, best time of my life.
That's amazing. You know, actually something you said just brought to mind something I've heard on another podcast with the host Amit Varma, who grew up in India, I assume sort of around the similar time that you did. And one of the things that he keeps referring to is that, you know, there was a certain set of books and everyone you knew who read in English basically read those. My phone just started playing the podcast. I'm so sorry. I don't even know how that happened. Oh my God, I was like, where is that coming from? Oh my goodness. Okay, well, how's that for AI? but sorry, so as I was saying, so, you know, everybody who read in English had access to a certain set of books, and this idea that you could go to a library where it was just the variety was so immense is something that I remember even, you know, like even my parents talking about when we moved to Canada. They were like, you don't understand how much variety you have available to you, which, you know, which we didn't grow up with. And so it was nice to hear you sort of speak to that as well. It sounds like.
And you see me behind me, and this is my living room. I have about 3,000 books here. Wow. And I have another 3,000 books in my office. And that's kind of almost for me, I would say, the only ambition I had in my life at that point, I like say when I'm about 18 years old, was I just need to make enough money and get a job where I can buy and read every book I want to, okay? And travel to a few places in the world and eat every meal I want to. Those are my basic assumptions about what I needed to do in life.
I love that. I love that. So how has your, I'm just going to skip forward a little bit. So that's where you started. How has your personal research interests now shifted? And now what excites you about the research that you're doing? Because I think it's changed over time.
Yes, exactly. So my first book, The Migrant's Table, was precisely about, in some ways, locating myself in a new world. So in some ways, the book is about what happens to immigrants, what do immigrants think about the changes that happens in their lives. And I looked at and showed things like how breakfast changes and lunch changes radically, but dinner, in fact, becomes more conserving, more conservative in some ways. And I argued in the book that for a Bengali in Chicago, especially if married and with a child, dinner becomes more Bengali than in Kolkata. Okay, so in some ways, this kind of, if you just look at breakfast, you'll say, oh my God, these people are totally assimilated. And if you look at dinner, you would say, wow, these folks have not assimilated at all. Again, this is an insight from an anthropologist, Mary Douglas, who said you have to look through the whole cycle to understand how food habits, what food habits are, how they change. And having finished that work, I went to work on the obvious other element of it, which is food in the public sphere, on the streets, in the marketplace. That's my book, The Ethnic Restaurateur. And it's about how immigrants have, in fact, always fed Americans, and especially in cities like New York and in Chicago. We have data from the 1850s on bakers, butchers, greengrocers, saloon keepers, tavern keepers. Most are foreign-born. They were initially Irish and Germans, and they became Eastern European Jews, Mediterranean, and now mostly Asian and Latinx. And so kind of having done these work, then the third edited book was Curried Cultures, which is about circulation of certain concepts born out of South Asia, but everywhere in the world, including complicated itineraries like curry raisu, in Japan, for instance, which comes kind of through the bit. Right now, I mean, as an academic, you're working on three projects: the one you're finishing, one you're middle of, one the other one you're looking at. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to do was sit down and spend some time reading theory. That's important in an academic world where you basically, I just finished close reading of three theory books: anthropologist Anne Mary Moll's Eating in Theory, Alan Ward's The Practice of Eating, and Corinne Pelluchon, who is a French philosopher. I think it's called Philosophy of Nourishment. And so I'm just finishing that and putting my thoughts down on paper. It's too many words now, 12,000 words. I have to turn it probably into 8,000 to 10,000 to get it published. As that is kind of on the back burner, simmering, I am looking at Afro-Asian connections, which is East Africa, the Swahili coast, and India. And this is partly elaborating my argument that I have been making that cuisines or cultures don't stop at borders. And they're, in fact, their connections and the interesting stories are connections and contact. And contact is not always sweet and sentimental. There's racism, there's all kinds of stuff going on. So that's the trigger for that was a little thing, which was the fruit of the baobab tree, which shows up in a 16th century cookbook from the Malwa Plateau called Nimatnama of the Sultans of Mandu, in which it is represented as Khorasani Imli, sometimes called Manduki Imli. It is neither Imli nor from Khorasan. It is, in fact, the baobab, the fruit of the baobab. So I just came back from East Africa pursuing the baobab and how it shows up in the marketplace, the fruit of the tree. And it is, in fact, used like tamarind. And so that was one. And I'm looking at other connections, like how, for instance, chapati changes when it globalizes, when it goes to out of the South Asian peninsula. When it goes to Southeast Asia, say to Malaysia, it becomes roti canai. In Zanzibar, it becomes chapati. They're called roti and chapati, but they're really what would be called parathas.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is partly because of mobility and circulation and durability. If you add fat to it, unlike rotis, which you have to just eat right away, they stay moist and edible, etc. So that's kind of a work that is emerging. That's probably I'm going to do over the next few years, which is the Afro-Asian connections, or kind of sometimes in Indian Ocean world. And my other work that is also going hand in hand is the role of markets, wholesale markets, and street vendors in the feeding of cities. And so in North America, in the 20th century, we basically saw the emergence of the supermarket. Okay, and the supermarkets are, they deliver commodities like flour and rice and beans and meats after the disassembly lines of Chicago quite well, but they still do poorly in delivering fruits and vegetables, even now. Okay, it's very difficult to get fruits, vegetables, in fact, good fish. So while on the other side, what feeds about 6 billion people in the world is not the supermarket system, but in fact, the wholesale market and the vendor system. Okay. But most of the writing is done on the supermarket system as if everyone goes to the supermarket. So the point is to recover that, look at that world, describe it, and a bit theorize about it. In a sense, it is not a bus and a truck and a car system, but in fact, it's a foot and a pedal system in the last mile. And that is under immense pressure in places like India, changing. And I want to record it and show its resilience in terms of creating autonomy and jobs in a world in which we are not producing enough jobs. Like in India, needs 8 to 12 million jobs, new jobs a year, just because of demographic change. And the Indian economy is not producing. That's why more than 90, 95% of the Indian population and parts of East Africa too, are in fact self-employed. So the supermarket system will destroy that. And so to keep that in view, and that's the work. Sorry, I went on and on. So as I said, it's feel free to cut me off.
No, it's so interesting. You don't want to. So just a couple of thoughts and then a last one for me before I hand over to Keith. You know, when you were talking about the Nimatnama and then the supermarkets, it's almost like a replacement, because often you see in food history that it's really the food of the wealthy that is deemed worthy of record, frankly. And so it's gone from a regional, local to this sort of global applicability where it's assumed in, you know, in the way that sometimes we talk about it. And, you know, I'm sure myself included at some points that people shop the way many of us do. And one of the things here in Bangalore that I've seen very different to other big Indian cities as well, is that the reliance on apps, because Bangalore has positioned itself as this very hyper tech city, is much higher. And all of the apps are incredibly hyper, like, and I'm not attaching any, you know, goodness or badness to that. They're just hyper apps. And one of the things you're seeing emerging is this pushing of 10-minute grocery deliveries.
Yeah.
And it's becoming more and more more and more popular, pardon me, in, you know, it's obviously very hyper urban areas in the city itself. My personal take on it is that I don't know that anyone needs groceries in 10 minutes. I think a little bit of planning is okay, because the health of, you know, the health and safety of the person who has to deliver that is more important than me needing something in 10 minutes. But it's really interesting to see how this idea of convenience mostly being attached to the idea of time, has come into the system in a really, really big way. And the idea is that it's this correlation that if I can pay for something, then I should have access to it in this, you know, in this very, very quote unquote convenient fashion only for the end consumer, which again is sort of a different iteration of various things in history where if people can pay for it, then at the cost of others, you know, they can have certain things. So, just various musings as you talked.
Yeah, no, and also, I mean, that's happened in New York, and especially through COVID that hastened it, you know, especially in the cooked food delivery sector. Like in New York City, we went up probably from 60,000 delivery folks to about 120,000 at one point. Wow. And of course, it gives people some degree of flexibility, but of course, it absorbs all the risk on their behalf. So a lot of these powered bikes, went up, and now I'm astonished how fast the food comes, and if anyone needs it that fast. But this kind of, that's the next version of fast food, is that fast delivery across the last mile or half a mile and stuff like that. And it always comes with some benefits and comes with some liabilities, right? And it's unequal, as you point out, unequally distributed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So last one for me. So as I, you know, mentioned upfront, one of the things that I admire about your work is how you've taken to social media and how you use social media to record observations and also parts of your writing at times and, you know, some of your research, so on and so forth. And I was just wondering, because, you know, it seems sitting in India right now, it seems a little bit like food of the subcontinent is finally starting to be spoken about in a democratic way that wasn't really the case maybe 15 or 20 years ago. And that only seems to be increasing. And sure, it's probably still a very small population of everyone who consumes the food, but you know, it's more vocal now than it previously was. And there's this interest in specifically the history of the food, if nothing else just yet. And so how have you observed this changing interest in the story of subcontinental food, whether it's the history or it's the politics or consumption or any particular aspect of it? And it looks from the outside like it's becoming more democratized. So, but is it, or is that kind of a superficial presence, but really, you know, not much has changed, or is it changing as we speak?
No, good question. And I mean, that's one of the reasons to take to social media. Because I think a lot of the interesting work is happening on Instagram and all kinds of platforms like that. But Instagram is particularly useful because I think it is less, there's less trolling and less masculine than Twitter, you know. And so there's a attention to the visual media has always been gendered in a particular way, and conversations and about it. So I'm finding it very useful to learn, and I'm watching and noticing what's happening is a deeper regionalization of Indian food, South Asian food, you know. And I mean, again, the last census showed what? We speak about 20,000 languages and dialects in South Asia. And I say wherever there's a dialect, there's a cuisine, okay? And so we have far to go, but I think what is exciting now, the Indian middle class, Indian professional class, is recognizing the power of provincial food. And that has happened before elsewhere. That has happened in Italy. That has happened in France. And I think, I mean, it is absurd that there's even something called Indian food, right? It's only, you can see that from very far away. It's like calling something European food. Well, it exists, but you have to figure out if it's like, if it's pierogies or it is pizza, you know, and comes from totally divergent spaces. And we are just on the cusp of, so one is that locality, variety, and its relationship to supply chains, the attention to, you know, various kinds of greens, for instance. Like I follow this woman on Instagram who does Odia greens, and she does artwork around it. And I'm Odia, partly. My mom is Odia, and I come from Odisha, and I have forgotten the names of some of those greens. So it's kind of a beautiful way to see how new platforms are used in this kind of, in archiving these various kinds of worlds, food worlds. And of course, there are limits to that, and there I see two particular limits. India has become a very dangerous place to talk about anything, partly because it's very noisy, it's very crowded, it's very aggressive, the way the political system is working. And so, for instance, if you go anywhere near, for instance, there's no other place in the world where food is as polarized and as polarizing as in India. And so, and that's what I understand, people have to be cautious. You cannot talk about everything everywhere. That is one of the limitations. The other limitation is a social structural limitation. Unless we have lower caste people, Dalits with higher rates of education and upward mobility and a strong presence, it'll be very difficult to get past the upper caste, upper class. I mean, I come from a Shudra past, but had been fortunate to basically climb the social ladder of social class. And that, so in that, in some ways, there's an opening of that world, right? And but The limitation there is a social structural limitation that we have a long distance to go to really get to. For instance, I'll give you an example. All the various rice wines and rice beers of the peasantries and the Adivasis of various parts of India. Yeah. If sake can be so big and so popular and so all over the place and everyone knows how to at least drink it a bit to be cosmopolitan, that hasn't happened yet. It's just emerging. Kind of those kinds of things when it happens and people of those communities who use them extensively become visible, I know we are getting there. But I personally am more optimistic than pessimistic in spite of the two limitations that I spoke of.
It's a perfect segue into a couple of my questions. So first of all, if any listeners don't know, I am a massive, massive fan of all of your writing. Specifically, I want to talk first about The Ethnic Restaurateur. That book radically changed a lot of my thought process and helped educate me into a different, just a different understanding of the plight of many South Asians coming here and trying to open restaurants. And I think one of the beautiful things that you highlight in that book that I think segues perfectly is what you kind of deem as the hierarchy of taste or the hierarchy of cuisine at that point. I think that my first kind of question is, since writing that book, have you seen a shift in the hierarchy of taste and the hierarchy of cuisine in the West specifically?
Excellent question. I also don't want to overgeneralize about the West. So I would say, looking from New York and informed a little bit about what's happening in London, two things. One is there is still continuity in terms of hierarchy. So for instance, and what does, for your audience, for instance, what does hierarchy mean? Hierarchy means that you can charge, say, $50, $60 for now, interestingly, Italian food that did not used to be. People used to whine about paying that much for Italian food. Surely for French food. Surely for, in New York City, sushi. I mean, Masa, other day I was checking. I haven't eaten at Masa yet because I can't afford to. I'm waiting for someone to take me there. It was $950. Thankfully, tips included. and to start off with. So, and for instance, it is impossible, still impossible, to do that with Indian food, to do that with Thai food, you know? And that's what I mean by hierarchy of taste, which is what people are willing to pay for at the highest level, which is related to prestige, which is sometimes related and sometimes not to popularity. There are two kind of frames, you know? Some things, the most popular foods in New York City are Italian, Chinese, and Mexican. Okay, but among them, only Italian can go up in terms of stratospheric prices, go up to 100 bucks per head if you had a glass of wine or two glasses of wine for a person. You almost can do that with Chinese food and it's tough to do with Mexican food. But let's talk about those examples. In fact, I predicted on the wave of writing this book, The Ethnic Restaurateur, in an interview, a long interview that got published in The Atlantic, as the future is expensive Chinese food, I argued that that's going to change with Chinese food. We are beginning to see mid-market and up-market Chinese food, partly because the demographics were changing. And the demographics was the slowing down of poor working class migration and increasing of professional migration, often movement of children of Chinese elites into American universities, for instance. Any American city now has many more interesting Chinese restaurants, and New York City has become a lot more interesting and a fun city to eat Chinese food. Partly the demand is there, and partly the rest of us who don't know upscale Chinese food are learning how to eat it, and it's various regionalization that's happening. So the hierarchy is there, but it's changing. Partly, of course, that's the power of having a conversation about it. It changes what's going on, and the other part has to be demographic change. The interesting thing, the most interesting thing, is how aspects of Mexican food, you can now do a restaurant like Afla, for instance, right? Enrique Olvera's place, and in fact, where you can charge $100 for Mexican food. And though that's only about 2% of Mexican restaurants, so but that's interesting how the hierarchy, there is a greater omnivorousness and scrambling of the hierarchy on one side of it. So I've seen that change since about what? Since 6 years, I finished writing that book. On the other side, in the basic structure of the hierarchy still in place, and I don't think that can be demolished as easily. It will take time in terms of changing our conceptions, changing our expectations from the demand side and then from the supply side, where people like you come in, where in some ways you are delivering a food and demanding a price that is analogous to, say, French or New American or Italian. And just to finish that thought, when I look at the Yelp data, for instance, and look at the percentage of upscale restaurants within a category, French, New American, Japanese still dominate. They can be almost 20 to 50% of French restaurants would be expensive. And while about 2% of Indian restaurants, 6% of Mexican restaurants, you know, and still 3% of Chinese restaurants. So that for me, the data is, these things move very slowly, but there's change and there's transformation.
I have a million follow-up questions. So I'll try to keep it somewhat limited. Yeah. So I guess the first is, I was in New York 3 weeks ago, and I was hanging out with the crew over at the Maca, Chef Chintan Bandya, who's become a good friend of mine. We were able to eat at Sema, which is kind of their new South Indian project, which is absolutely one of the best meals of my life. I've noticed, especially in New York, that I feel like the needle is moving. The massive success of the Maca, you know, they're nominated for James Beard as a restaurant and Chef Chintan. They're in finalists this year. Like I think that what I'm seeing, at least like boots on the ground, is a lot of people are like discovering actual Indian food for the first time. And of course we use that in air quotes because what is Indian food, right? I think, so my follow-up question is, how do we get that needle to move? What actions can people take? I understand we vote with our dollar, so going to support these places, but supporting the status quo, if that's relegating Indian food to the buffet line, just perpetuates the same status quo. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think in some ways the conversation, to have a different conversation, and Pete Wells, the New York Times restaurant critic, visited Chintan's restaurants and then reviewed them is part of that, right? Which in my book I called the kind of the taste makers, you know. So partly what the customer wants, partly what the supplier delivers, higher quality and making an argument. But then commentators are very important, like our previous discussion on the role of Instagram. You know, there's a certain kind of plate presentation, certain kind of lighting. Okay, so that people can take terrific pictures of the food and put it on Instagram. And that's going to be important. And so these intermediaries play an important role. So, and that has happened partly because of changing notions of it, partly honestly because of Black Lives Matter in New York City, which has really opened up the idea that that basically closed-minded assumptions of what is good taste. That can a Nigerian restaurant, you know, perform at the level of, say, an haute cuisine French restaurant? And we are beginning to see that, beginning to see the opening up of it. And people like, say, Ligaya Mishan of New York Times, when she used to write Under 25 or Cheap Eats, what used to be called, you know, and she has done a lot writing and provoking. And then specifically now, she even wrote a book on Filipino cuisine. And so I think Filipino cuisine is a very similar spot like Indian food in some ways, but also kind of a different spot in the hierarchy of taste. So I think that discussion is changing, and it's changing with people like Chintan transforming a taste, delivering a different thing, commentators talking about it. I mean, I think these two things are important. It's taste and it's talk. Okay, these two forms of orality, because at the end of it, food is very private because it's in our mouth. You don't know what it tastes like to me. So we have to talk about it to socialize taste. And so reading, writing, Instagram posting are all very important part of a public discussion on taste. And I think that's happening with Indian food, food from South Asia, with its own limitations. For instance, we still don't have attention to Bangladeshi food, no, regional Bangladeshi food. And that hopefully will emerge down the road. But yes, there is an opening up. And I think what has happened overall is the kind of a encrusted hierarchy of taste is falling apart because of the role of various kinds of immigrants, both in producing food and commenting on it. And if you have seen, I mean, Tejal Rao and many others now of South Asian niche kind of a cultural heritage. Tejal Rao comes from South Asia via East Africa, right? And these commentators are now, Soleil Ho, for instance, in San Francisco, is transforming also various kinds of taste. So the commentators are changing right now. They're becoming more Asian and Latinx with closer experience to these kinds of cuisines, which then are drawing other people like you in close proximity to saying that, and you have had what, a decade-long relationship with it, and in some ways taking the risk to say, I will do my interpretation of it and let's see how it gets received. In some ways, it's becoming a lot more aesthetically kind of open rather than closed.
Well, thank you, because that's a question I've had for you for a while. So it's nice to be able to just shoot that over. So we kind of drilled in deep. We drilled in on that 50-foot level of mm-hmm. of kind of the restaurant scene and the progression of cuisine. I want to zoom way out for a minute and ask you what's probably going to be a very tricky question as our last question. Mm. So everything that you're researching, everything that you're reading, everything you're seeing, what do you feel is the greatest threat to food and food security in the world today?
Complicated question. It's part of it is where you are. And so I would say in India, it is Hindu nationalism and a kind of a close-mindedness about almost nowhere else in the world are people mobilized by disgust and disdain towards other people's food. Okay. And that cannot work in a democracy. Okay. And we may not like other people. We may not like other people's food. Excuse me, sorry. So we may not like other people. We may not like other people's food, but we have to tolerate it if we're going to be in a democracy with a civil society. So in some parts of the world, it is a very acute crisis in India, I think. And that's one part of it. And which is linked, of course, to, in some paradoxical way, to the biggest threat, of course, is climate change and water, access to water, production of food. And that's going to be a challenge. And in fact, it is a good idea to reduce our consumption of large mammals, okay, especially land animals, okay? That's important. But to use that ecological argument to bully minority taste is the peculiar paradox of the situation in South Asia. So I say there are two threats. One is the climate change, especially climate change's impact on access to water, okay? And especially that, again, let's just stick to South Asia, you know, is going to be the unevenness of the monsoon, where still huge parts of Indian agriculture are dependent on monsoon. We have not been able to provide an alternative way of accessing water. That's going to get worse, and it's going to get hotter, and it's going to often get drier in some parts and wetter in other parts, like say the Bay of Bengal and say Bangladesh, right? That's going to put pressure on people. About a third of Bangladesh is a couple of inches above water, okay? And that is both salination of the water, that is also water rising and polluting of water. That is a big challenge in the context of, I would say, a cultural, political challenge of disgust and disdain towards other people's food. And these two, I think, are the, I would say, now have become short-term, medium-term challenges for sure. And of course, in the long run, we're all dead, right? Let's not end on that note. I would say in the short and the medium term, those are the real changes, real kind of a challenges. How to manage the climate change challenges and the social cultural change challenges in places like South Asia.
Absolutely. Now that's really interesting. This idea of social and cultural challenges to food. I grew up in the Middle East, and growing up, I was very much raised with the narrative that India is this land of acceptance where everybody is able to be themselves, so on and so forth. And you know, we had certain restrictions on the diet there because we lived in Islamic countries at those at that time. And now living in India and seeing it flipped on its head in quite a dramatic way has been incredibly, disheartening, frankly.
It is. I personally think that's the beauty of India, is its multiplicity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Remember what we said, right? If you speak 20,000 languages, your food are going to be different, and we better be tolerant about it. And that intolerance about religion and language that is becoming more and more visible. And by the way, thankfully, hopefully still a minority, but a very loud and shrill minority. Okay. And that is a danger to cultural, the beauty of India, I think. Still is. And hopefully, thankfully, most people are hopefully not poisoned by that. And we will get out of this at some point of time where that kind of mobilization people see through as a short-term mobilization that is destroying the social fabric, civic fabric of India, and especially the state you are in now. It's absurd that Karnataka has gone ballistic on this hysteria on other people's food. That's just unbelievable.
Many years ago, I used to teach I taught in the slums for a few years, and 5-6 years later, I went back to visit. And this is just when everything had sort of just started. And I'll never forget, I was talking to one mom who had taken her kids out of the public school. And I asked her why, because I knew they weren't really able to afford private school. And so I asked her, why have you done this? You know that, they'd be fine in the school. And she said, because they stopped letting them eat in the school. And we're talking about a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, and they took eggs to school as part of their lunch, which was a once in 2-week occurrence. And it was taken from them, and they were made examples of. And so, the parent, despite living in a low choice environment, the parent made the choice not to allow their kids to face that fate on a regular, their foresight. I commend her for it, but. Yeah, so it's
sad and it's terrible. It's, I think it's destructive of everything that's beautiful about India. It's multiplicity. No other place in the world, I think, is comparable to India in its kind of the fabric of multiple threads woven together. And the fraying that is happening is kind of, it's terrifying.
Absolutely. Yes. echo on that front. So this conversation has been super interesting. I mean, we've spoken for a short amount of time, but we've touched on multiple continents. We've touched on the Indian Ocean and what happens across there. We've touched on the power of regional food and caste and climate change and all of these other topics. Would you be able to leave our listeners with a list of maybe 3 to 5 recommended readings for anybody who's interested to learn beyond their plate?
Oh, wow. Kind of that's a big, big challenge, because I'm surrounded by so many books. I would say, maybe I should walk around and take a look. Do you want me to kind of stick to South Asia?
Or three books that you found to be interesting, impactful, however you see it, doesn't have to be. So.
I would say in some ways, okay, give me 2 minutes. You can edit this, right? Let me pick up 3 books.
Okay, awesome.
Yep. I feel like I could go on for about another hour. and touch on so many things.
Quite easily, yeah.
It was funny when he dropped that C word, that cast word. I was harking back to the presentation that you showed me and how good it was and how I always want you to just put that out there, but I totally get what you haven't.
That paper is going to be published.
It's so good, Rakhmi. You did an incredible job on that.
Yeah, it's in the proceedings.
Okay, so it's like three books. In fact, as I said, my problem always, it's like choosing between your children. Which one is your favorite right now? It's like I have thousands of books, but I'm going to, that has shaped my thinking recently. And it is good to think about whether you're thinking in, say, North America or you're thinking in India. So one is this book that came out by a sociologist. It says The Problem with Feeding Cities. Okay. So it's Andrew Diener. It's called The Social Transformation of Infrastructure, Abundance, and Inequality in America, which takes the case of Philadelphia and, in fact, looks at this transition. When we move from a wholesale system to the supermarket system and what was gained and what was lost. So this is Andrew Diener, The Problem with Feeding Cities. And the other one is, in fact, this is almost like a promise to myself. Chitrita Banerjee, many of you would have read her work. She produced a tiny little book called A Taste of My Life. Okay, and I'm yet to read it, but I know I have read her other work and previous work, her beautiful work. I think one of them came out in Gastronomica on Boti, the knife that is a squatting knife. And so this is Chitrita Banerjee's A Taste of My Life, produced by Picador India. And that would be kind of my soon next to read. The other one is Mayuk Sen's latest book called Tastemakers, Seven Immigrant Women Who Revolutionized Food in America. Okay. Readable. Mayuk is a terrific writer. And he's, in fact, his next book is on Indian actress in Hollywood who had to flee from her Indian heritage and pretended she was born in New Zealand because this is the time when Hollywood would not accept mixed race lead actresses in this particular case. So that's his next book, but this is on seven immigrant women who revolutionized food in America. So it's called Tastemakers by Mayuk Sen. Three books, there you have it.
Perfect. And what a range of books too. So we'll link all those books in the show notes for everyone who's keen. Dr. Ray, thank you so much. I know I speak on behalf of Keith and I when I say we could have easily had this conversation over the next 3 hours. but we, with respect for your time, we'll stop now. But this has really been an honor. And thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is fun. And Keith, I have to come and eat your food.
Anytime, it would be an honor.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we will see you next time on More Than Masala.